Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
It's a gas!
It's a $700 million gas power plant promising a reliable energy source and jobs for Superior. But would it continue to feed our addiction to fossil fuel?
Minnesota Power and Dairy Lynch have been framing the narrative as this is like a bridge fuel that is a lot cleaner, but they're leaving out the emissions that are generated and the health risks.
Plus, she hit the charts as Molly and the Haymakers. Now, we catch up with Molly and the Danger Band.
Everybody, they heard the news. They're strapping up their walking shoes.
Those stories and the regional news and review after this.
They're queued up.
Coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
It's a gas!
It's a $700 million gas power plant promising a reliable energy source and jobs for Superior. But would it continue to feed our addiction to fossil fuel?
We see it again as renewable enabling. It can go right back offline when the wind picks up or the sun comes out.
Plus, she hit the charts as Molly and the Haymakers. Now, we catch up with Molly and the Danger Band.
Everybody, they heard the news. They're strapping up their walking shoes. They heard a call.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. It's a $700 million project for Superior that promises to bring a more reliable, cleaner energy source to the region and, of course, jobs. But critics say it also continues to promote reliance on fossil fuels, ignoring basic concerns about climate change. It is the 625-megawatt Nemadji Trail Energy Center, or NTEC, planned for Superior by 2025. It would be operated jointly by Minnesota Power and La Crosse-based Dairyland Power. Last September, we spoke with representatives from those two firms, as well as environmentalists opposed to the plans. Here's our conversation from then, beginning with two representatives from the Sierra Club, Jenna Yako, speaking with us from Duluth, and Jadeen Sonata from Madison. Welcome to Simply Superior, Jenna and Jadeen.
Thank you so much for having us.
So let's start out talking about natural gas. While natural gas is not as clean as solar or wind energy, it is one of the cleaner fossil fuels, right?
This is Jadeen, and we actually like to talk about gas not as natural. That's often a term that the industry uses to hide the fact that it's really just a fossil fuel. And oftentimes they'll kind of tout it as clean, reliable energy as part of a transition fuel. Actually, there are a lot of really impactful upstream emissions of methane throughout the extraction and transportation process that pose some significant threats to climate change through greenhouse gas release. So when you take into account...
Well, actually, let me pick up on your very first point. If it's not natural gas, and I've been using the term for some time, so if I'm guilty of it, so be it. So what is it? If it isn't natural gas, is it the methane that might be affiliated with cows, or is it stuff that human beings make?
Yeah, natural is just kind of a descriptor, and it is gas that is existing in the world. You could make a claim that most anything is natural that we're finding, you know, in the ground, but you could say the same about oil or coal. And this gas can be violently extracted from the ground. There's a lot of harmful chemicals that are used in that process oftentimes. And the methane that you mentioned is a really potent greenhouse gas, more than 80 times as powerful as carbon dioxide when we're talking about warming. And that's one of the major concerns with climate change. So, John, I don't know if you would like to add anything on to that.
Sure. I can add a little bit about the kind of the technical pieces about fracked gas. Hydraulic fracturing or fracking has really transformed the fossil fuel industry and has made gas really one of our largest threats to climate and has fueled the climate crisis. pro-fracking lobbyists like to claim that burning fracked gas is a lot cleaner than burning coal. So like Minnesota Power and Dairyland have been kind of framing the narrative as this is like a bridge fuel that is a lot cleaner than coal, but they're leaving out the emissions that are generated and the health risks that are created during the fracking process itself, and then the potential leaks from the pipelines that are needed to transport fracking from place to place.
Mm-hmm. Would the fracking happen here in Superior, or is that elsewhere? I guess I could have them describe how the plant works, but you tell me.
Right, yeah. I think the utilities would probably have a clearer understanding of where and how, but the fracking will actually take place on a different site or sites and then be transported to Superior, Wisconsin for burning.
Mm-hmm. So going on with your rebuttal to the claims that it produces nearly a third less carbon dioxide than coal and almost half less than oil. What's wrong with a third less and a half less of carbon dioxide?
Absolutely. We learned recently from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change climate report that called out methane specifically, which is the gas that is emitted through burning and transporting of fracked gas. They called that out specifically as an extremely potent greenhouse gas, which is more than 80 times as powerful as carbon dioxide pollution. So a fossil fuel power plant, such as a fracked gas power plant like NTEC, is really a really, really big climate polluter.
Mm-hmm. We're speaking with Jenna Yako and Jadine Sonata of the Sierra Club. We're talking about the, and now you got me feeling a little bit nervous saying it, the natural gas plant, or the gas plant that is slated for Superior, a joint venture of Minnesota Power and La Crosse-based Dairyland Power. And we're talking about the environmental impacts of it. Is it something that you're just opposing here in Superior or anywhere? At the end of the day, people still do need energy, and are we ready completely yet with renewable sources? By the way, there's no end of windmill parts coming in the harbor, and we love this in Duluth Superior. You know, are we completely ready for those sources, and would that be enough? Or, as I'm sure the companies would argue, are bridge sources necessary?
This is JD. To the question about whether we need this gas or whether we need fossil fuels and whether we're ready, the technology is definitely there and continuing to develop. And when we look at it, it doesn't make a ton of sense to continue expanding fossil fuel infrastructure, even when looking at things like cost. There's a 2019 study that was published by the Rocky Mountain Institute that looked at 88 proposed gas plants and found that 90% of them, including NTEC, would be more costly than if the utilities invested instead in cleaner options like wind, solar, or energy efficiency. So there's really no reason not to make this cleaner transition, and we don't want to get ourselves entrenched with more fossil fuel infrastructure. If the NTEC were built, we'd be, you know, locking ourselves into using it for the next couple decades.
This recently was reviewed by an appeals court in Minnesota, which came down favorably toward the plant. In short, they said, accordingly, substantial evidence supports the commission's determination that NTEC best serves the public interest. Jenna Yako, what are they getting wrong?
I'll respond that when Minnesota Power applied to Minnesota's Public Utilities Commission, the administrative law judge overseeing that application and case came out with the opposite conclusion, that NTEC is not needed for Minnesotans for energy, that it would be much more costly than clean renewable energy, and that it would be eventually a stranded asset that customers like myself would be paying for down the line. And I think there are differences between the two governing utility bodies in both states. But for me, it's just immensely disappointing that we are still having conversations about if and when we should be building new fossil fuel power plants and infrastructure when my community has been experiencing poor air quality throughout the summer due to wildfires up north and in Canada because our climate is changing.
Again, we are speaking with Jenna Yako of the Sierra Club and her colleague, Jadine Sonata, also from the Sierra Club, Jenna from Duluth and Jadine from Madison. Lastly, is there a way to have a meeting of the minds? Is there any kind of a compromise? You know, if you sat down with the two industry representatives who we're talking to next, what could you agree on, Jadine?
I think that if I was sitting down with these two utilities, I think something that we could agree on is that, you know, clean energy is where the future is heading. It's where we need to be, both, you know, like environmental-wise, health-wise, cost-wise, for every reason. The only reason why we're kind of like stuck in this fossil fuel phase right now is because there's a lot of profit there, which will be, I think, decreasing as time goes on. It's just like the way things have been. And clean energy is the future. It's what we're going to be moving towards. So there, from my perspective, is no reason not to pursue that now.
All right. Jenna?
I would want to sit down with Minnesota Power and Dairyland leadership and ask them, what kind of future do you envision? What kind of world do you want to leave your children and grandchildren and future generations beyond ours? And I would just ask Minnesota Power and Dairyland's leadership to really dig deep and think about what our communities deserve. Think about how the science is just incompatible with building new fossil fuel power plants and infrastructure. We know that a path to 100% renewable and clean energy is possible, and Minnesota Power and Dairyland can partner and help us get there.
All right. We've been speaking with Jenna Yako and Jadine Sonata of the Sierra Club about the gas plant, we'll call it, proposed for Superior. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciate it, Robin.
And now, the other side. We're joined by John Carr, the Vice President of Power Supply for Dairyland Power Cooperative, speaking from La Crosse, and Josh Skelton, the Chief Operating Officer of Minnesota Power in Duluth. Hello, Josh and John.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
Hello.
And I have to say, it was completely by accident that we ended up with Jenna and Jadine from the Sierra Club and Josh and John from the power companies. So let me start by asking something that they said. I used the term natural gas, and they said, well, you know, we take a little exception to that because all gas is natural gas, just like all fossil fuels. Oil is natural oil and coal is natural coal. So they said it's a bit of a misnomer to call it natural gas. That makes it sound a little bit more environmentally friendly. And in fact, like the other fossil fuels, it's treated and processed like everything else is. So do they have a point?
Well, hey, Robin, this is Josh. You know, certainly we didn't give the name natural gas. What we're looking for is a energy asset that can meet our needs on that end. So the genesis of the name natural gas, I don't know that I'm overly familiar with where that came from, but certainly this project presents opportunities for us to fuel on what is a natural gas asset and its capabilities to advance technology to other gas in the future, like hydrogen, are key attributes to the technology providers and an evolution that we'll be following closely as this project moves forward.
Sure. Fair enough. You did not name it. So, well, I think both of you term it as a bridge energy source between the more traditional fossil fuels and renewable sources. Why is a bridge necessary? And in fact, Josh, I would say we're familiar with Minnesota Power's wind operations because we see the windmill parts constantly coming into Duluth Superior Harbor, and we'd like that. But in any case, why not put all your energy, pun intended, toward renewable energy?
I can take that, Robin. This is John Carr. And, you know, from Dairyland's perspective, you know, we do use the term a bridge fuel when we refer to natural gas. I think we also use the term renewable enabling. The renewable enabling piece for us with natural gas, these resources have the ability to sit idle and ready and waiting. So during those periods where the wind is blowing and production is very high, and the sun is shining and production is very high, and those resources are able to meet demand, that's great. But there are those periods of times where, nighttime, for example, or some of these very warm days where the wind isn't blowing as strong and it's very warm and demand for air conditioning is still very high. We have the ability to bring that natural gas plant into service and still provide reliable energy on demand. So we see it again as renewable enabling. It can go right back offline when the wind picks up or the sun comes out.
Mm-hmm. Josh, why Superior? You're Minnesota Power, and I guess...
Hey, Robin, before I jump to that, I just talking sure. a little bit about how it fits into Minnesota's bridge is the, you know, we're very proud of our record. We're the first utility here in the state of Minnesota to reach a 50% renewable. So our transformation's been well underway. While we've been adding to your point of the awesome nacelles and turbine blades coming out of the harbor and working their way across the prairies and to different locations here in the United States, we've added a lot of wind. In addition to that, we're now looking to add up to 30 megawatts of solar. So, again, very proud of where we've been. But as we transition, we also have to keep that reliability high. Our customers in northern Minnesota have some of the highest demand around the clock. So 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. We need to have that energy supply to maintain reliability, not just for our customers, but for the region. And certainly an asset like the proposed NTEC project fills in those voids, like John said, when the sun's not shining and the wind's not blowing. We need energy to help fill those voids to keep those customers safe, especially in the coldest of cold days and maybe in the warmest of warm spells like we've had here this summer.
Mm-hmm. So why Superior?
For Superior and Iron, it's a great location for many reasons. So Elite has a presence there with Superior Water, Light, and Power, who's also a customer of Minnesota Power. So relationship there. But its site itself, the site itself is an industrial site, shovel ready for a project like the NTEC project. So it has infrastructure already in place for natural gas. Its location actually does a lot to stabilize the grid for regional reliability. The interconnection is available there on the electrical infrastructure as well. So those are some reasons that we think Superior is a great location.
Robin, this is John Carr. Also very important for Darylin is the willing partnership that we have with Elite and Minnesota Power that brings us in and allows us to participate in this project. We can achieve a scale in this resource that we might not be able to achieve on our own. The other big reason for us is the proximity to our service territory. So while we're not right there in Superior, Darylin is actually serving a large portion of northwest Wisconsin, so just to the south and east. We are serving Bayfield Electric, Price Electric, Polk Burnett, Barron, and Jump River. These are co-ops in the northwest segment of Wisconsin. So a lot of the rural area there is being served by Darylin, and the Superior location is an excellent fit for us for those reasons.
We're speaking with John Carr, the Vice President of Power Supply for Darylin Power, and Josh Skelton, Chief Operating Officer of Minnesota Power. You've just had a ruling in your favor last week by a Minnesota appeals court that reversed an opinion by an administrative law judge, and now you're headed up the further in the judicial ladder, I assume, where it could go back against you. Is all this worth it in the court, especially with the legal fees, versus, again, proceeding with wind or other solar or other renewables, which, as you mentioned, you're going to go to anyway? So is it worth the court battles, both in terms of cost and time? Josh Skelton of Minnesota Power?
You know, the Court of Appeals decision was an important step forward for Nemadji Trail Energy Center project. The Court of Appeals decision held strongly that they agreed with our record. In fact, it supported the decisions that were made by the MPUC to be a part of that portfolio to serve those customers going forward. So we believe it to be an important part of our achieving our transformation to more renewable sources and less focused on carbon. With our bold goal of getting to zero carbon emission by 2050, we need an incremental step to be 80% by 2035. The NTEC project helps us get there going further and faster by adding renewables and having a backstop to have dispatchable resource when it's required.
Mm-hmm. What about the time aspect? I know you have a deadline. You'd like to start construction on the plant. How long would you have a legal battle going?
Well, it's important for us. This is Josh again. Important for us to follow our permits in hand, right? So we're ready to work on this project with Dairyland. We've been working through the regulatory and legal proceedings with our intent to be commercial by 2025. So that's what's in our portfolio. We're working through that, but of course we need permits in hand, and we're going to work through answering all the questions in the regulatory processes in the legal processes as they come up, and hopefully we can hold on to our schedule, and that's our intent, is to deliver this energy when our customers need it most.
Yeah, you know, the timing is important here, and I think from Dairyland's perspective here, we have retired our 345 megawatt coal-fired plant in Genoa. That was just done here June of this year. Not too long ago, we retired five units at our legacy Alma plant in Alma, Wisconsin. That was roughly 200 megawatts. We have added 180 megawatts of wind, another 25 megawatts of utility scale solar, and we have another 149 megawatts of solar that will be brought on in the next 2 years or so. But from our perspective, again, in this transition, the timing is very important. The need to have the resource there to reliably meet our members' requirements and to be there as a backup during those periods of time where we don't have the wind or sun available.
And lastly, outside of the courts, I asked the environmentalists if they would be willing to sit down with you. And so I would ask you the same thing. What would you propose to them if we had, let me get this straight here, Jenna, Jadine, Josh, and John all together in a room? What sort of compromise do you think both sides could live with?
Well, hey, this is Josh, Robin. I think from the very onset of this project, we've held a number of open houses. We're inviting to get those views and comments and concerns around our project. And then the regulatory and legal processes themselves invite additional public opinion. Where we can find common ground to deliver the energy and meet the needs of all of our stakeholders, we want to make sure we can find that path. And I think that's where we get to in these regulatory outcomes, these legal proceedings, allow us a way to meet those obligations. So I think we've had a very strong outreach through those very open, very public processes, and we continue to look for ways to always improve our project to serve all stakeholder needs.
This is John Carr at Dairyland. From our perspective, we're always open to sitting down, having that thoughtful conversation in terms of planning. In fact, that typifies our cooperative business model, right? Working with our members to shape our future, concern for community, all those things. We'd be more than happy to have those conversations. But we still have to meet our members' needs reliably and cost-effectively here in the near term.
All right. We've been speaking with John Carr, the Vice President for Power Supply for Dairyland Power Cooperative, and Josh Skelton, Chief Operating Officer of Minnesota Power. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Robin.
Coming up, the music of Molly and the Danger Band. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. If you've attended Big Top Chautauqua or Bayfield's Apple Fest, you're familiar with Molly and the Danger Band. Before we explain that name, or let her explain it, we'll note that it's a new incarnation of Molly and the Haymakers, who appear through Warner Records. Molly is Molly Otis of Hayward, who's described as a powerful vocalist, plays multiple instruments, including mandolin, guitar, drums, and fiddle. We spoke with her last fall, right after Applefest. Here's our conversation. Welcome to Simply Superior, Molly Otis.
Hi, Robin. Thanks for having me today.
So, like your band, you've gone by different surnames, right?
I have, over the years, over the decades, I should say. Back in the Haymaker days, which was, you know, the 90s, I was Molly Shear and was married to Fred Shear. And we split. And then for years, I've been single. And then I remarried Glenn Stoddart. And so I was going as Molly Stoddart for a number of years. And my husband, unfortunately, died of cancer about four years ago. So I've gone back to my maiden name, Molly Otis. And we shorten it for Molly O so that it's easy for everybody at this point.
All right. Well, there's only one Molly. There's only going to be one Molly on this show. And Molly and the Danger Band, I'll let you explain. Don't do it yet. Let's keep people in suspense. But the Haymakers, Haymakers is H-E-Y makers, right? So what did that mean?
Well, good question. What did it mean? We, you know, we were just this little band out of Hayward, Wisconsin. And we were very focused on writing original music. We'd work hard. We had a little studio out at the milk house in my hobby farm that I had outside of Hayward. And we would record and write and, you know, just really work at being an original band. And then we'd go and do gigs and, you know, play covers and, you know, be a good party band. So anyway, we would do that. And all of a sudden we bent the ear of some Nashville executives. And we had two solid offers, RCA put an offer on the table, as did Warner Reprise. This, of course, was maybe 90, 91. Mm-hmm. We wanted to kind of do our Haymaker, you know, from Hayward, but we changed it to Haymakers as in like the hay, you know. Back in the 90s, that was cool, right?
Well, anyway, I'm sure we did that Warner Reprise didn't worry too much about Hayward, Wisconsin, right?
No, but, you know, when you put out a national product like we did with Warner Reprise, mm-hmm. You do have to do a name search, and there was another Haymaker band out there, and we had to get a release, you know, from them that they wouldn't sue us for the name or anything.
When were they H-E-Y or H-A-Y?
I think they were H-A-Y, but we had to go through all this with them, and, you know,
you had to make
hay, right?
All right. How far did the Haymakers go, or?
Well, the Haymakers dissolved, I would say, the late 90s. We peaked, you know, early 90s as far as commercial success. We were an independent group, and we were doing kind of, we used to call it cowpunk. You know, back then you had Katie Lang and Dwight Yoakam kind of, you know, breaking down doors a little bit in the country music industry. And Reprise, Warner Reprise, had both of those artists, and they were the ones that signed us. So we were kind of on the cutting edge. But we did get some commercial success. We had two songs that hit the charts, the country charts, and we had a good roll, you know, and I enjoyed all of it. I really did. I have to say it was stressful, and I was a young mother, so I was, you know, always coordinating nannies and children on the road with me. But we traveled all around the world and all around the country, and we got to play with a lot of big names. You know, one night we'd be opening up for Alan Jackson, and then the next night we'd be at some little, you know, small town at their rodeo on a flatbed trailer, and nothing worked, and it was raining on us, you know. So it was the highs and lows of that time, and but we had a lot of fun, and I think we produced some really good music during that time frame. And you know, we got up in the 30s on the charts, but we never broke into that, you know, those top 10. But our video did. We had two videos that went in the top 10, and that was at the onset of the whole country music video charts.
I'm looking online. I did a little search here, and Mountain of Love pops up.
Mountain of Love had a successful video, and then the one Chasing Something Called Love was our first release, and I think it got to 32 or something on the charts, and it had a top 10 video. Was our first release. So that was exciting times. You know, and this is when they say luck, you know, a lot of the industry is luck. And what had happened, all the big names had released slow ballads and slow songs at the time. And we had a short song that was, you know, up tempo and had good energy. And it just worked out in our favor, and we did really well with it. And it got us on the charts, and it got us opening for big names. And, you know, I'd call it moderate success.
All right. Well, hey, moderate success is better than would-be successes is way better. We are speaking with Molly Otis, formerly of Molly and the Haymakers. That's Hay, H-E-Y, Makers. And the Haymakers have gone on, and now we have Molly and the Danger Band. So tell me a bit about the band. What's the focus of the band this time?
Well, the focus of the band now, it's, you know, I'm still writing and recording, and my most recent release is at least, what, 5-6 years old now. But, you know, I put together a band just to play music and have fun. And we've been playing off and on now for 15 years, and it is still that way. But we do write music and we do record, but we do it in a different type of fulfillment. And we all just get along so well. I have 3 members in the band, and there's never been a harsh word between us.
Aren't you breaking some band code by not arguing? You're supposed to fight. Right. Come on now. I mean, what do you think Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young is all about? You know, how 4 different ways to have the same fight, you know?
Yeah, exactly. You know, just taking that career edge off of it and just making it about having a good time and playing music. We just want to play music.
All right. Well, rather than talking about it, let's hear some of your music. Let's start with Justified, and I believe it's from the album Justified, correct?
Correct.
And tell us a bit about it.
Well, it was motivated by my husband, who was a civil rights lawyer, and he took on some really amazing cases, one of which was my lawsuit about music as protected speech. And that's a whole other story. But it was just that he was so motivational to me that he, when he got behind something and fought for it, he felt totally justified. And he won many great civil rights cases, and he lost a lot. He knew that. He said, this is really a dicey thing. But it so inspired me, and he helped me write this song. And he, you know, it was kind of that motivation of, if you feel justified about something or a cause, you should get up and do something about it.
All right. So let's hear Justified by Molly and the Danger Band.
Come on.
that was Justified by Molly and the Danger Band. We're speaking with Molly Otis, who is the front person of the Danger Band. And I'm sorry, I'm still going to keep your band's name in suspense, what it means. But you can tell us who the other members are and what they play.
My longtime member is Randy Wydra. He spent a lot of time up in the Duluth area and then moved to Hayward back in the late 90s. And Randy and I have been playing together 15 years, and he's the bass player, and he also triggers drums with his feet. Okay. So he's our, we call him the low frequency technician. And Randy sings and he writes. And then my other musical companion is Tom Drawn, who is really from the folk and bluegrass genre. And he has been producing, writing, playing forever. This is what he does. He teaches music up at Northern College in Ashland. And he's the full-time musician in the group, whereas Randy and I, we have other gigs, let's put it that way. But Tom Drawn is just a great musician, and he's one of the few people I know that has perfect pitch. He can pull an A note out of the air.
All right. Well, let's hear another one of the three of you. This is Rum. Can you set it up for us?
This was a fun song. I went down with my husband to Mexico, and we got down there, and it was raining and cold, and everybody was miserable. And my husband put $20 in the tip jar and got the band, you know, all excited and playing, and it just broke the ice for the whole night. You know, it was just that fun evening that just happens by giving the band a nice tip by being kind.
All right, and here's Rum by Molly and the Danger Band.
Cheap t-shirt. Don't
And that was Rum by Molly and the Danger Band. We're speaking with Molly Otis. And so now, drum roll please, because you play the drums too, right?
I do play the drums. I don't think very well, but in a pinch.
All right. Well, my drum roll for your explanation of the name Danger Band. What's that all about?
Okay, the Danger Band. And it is a funny thing. We always laugh on stage. We say, we are the Danger Band, but don't worry, we're only a danger to ourselves. I had a little wine bar in downtown Hayward. There was just a big shelf that I used to put displays on, and we cleared it, and I would crawl out there and play music while people were drinking wine. And it became a thing. And pretty soon, basically on a wide shelf that was at least 10 feet high, we would have four people. And no one ever got hurt, but it was amazing. And we called it the Danger Stage. And everybody loved the Danger Stage. And then we became the Danger Band. And we've kept that name, even though I sold the bar and the business. The name has lived on.
All right. Well, we are again speaking with Molly Otis of Molly and the now explained Danger Band. How about one more to take us out? Castle Rock?
Castle Rock. Well, I love playing fiddle, and this was my chance to play some fiddle. And this song also features Ed Willett on the cello. He used to play with Ricky Lee Jones, and also he was in the LA Symphony for 13 years. And I just think he's a real gift to the Northern Wisconsin music scene.
Well, it takes one to recognize one. Thank you, Molly Otis.
Thanks, Robin.
Coming up, the regional news and review. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
And Rick Lubbers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Hello, Rick.
Hi, Robin.
So, Danny, we just heard all the arguments for and against the proposed gas plant in Superior, and it's not the only gas plant proposed for Wisconsin. And in fact, the whole discussion about fossil fuels is raging worldwide with a ban of imports of oil and gas from Russia. So what's going on locally? What are some of the discussions?
Well, here locally with the Superior Gas Plant, as you are aware, it's a $700 million project to basically create a state-of-the-art natural gas plant here in Superior. And that project was approved by the Public Service Commission a couple of years ago now, but Clean Wisconsin and the Sierra Club filed a lawsuit against the PSC for its approval of that project. And that case is still pending. There was an order that was issued in February to extend the timeline for a decision. And the work is still ongoing to obtain all the necessary permits for that project. But at the same time, regulators also recently approved another natural gas plant near Wausau. Proponents say that it will create jobs and that it will help bridge the gap, you know, when the sun isn't shining and the wind isn't blowing, you know, as these utilities shift to more renewable resources, but opponents say that this is unnecessary. There are other options like renewable energy, like battery storage that could be used to provide the reliability and affordability that utilities need to, you know, meet the demands of their customers and their ratepayers.
Well, someone who's likely to be asked his opinion on the gas plant and other local matters will soon be giving his thoughts as a private citizen and not a public official. State Representative Nick Milroy just made an announcement.
That's right, Robin. Representative Nick Milroy is now the eighth Democrat to quit the state assembly. The South-ranked Democrat announced Thursday that he won't seek re-election in November. He said in a statement that his children are at an age where they need their dad more than the legislature does. And he added that he spent too many days and nights in Madison away from his wife, Julie, and you know, Milroy was first elected to the assembly in 2008 after former Representative Frank Boyle retired. And in 2020, he narrowly fended off a challenge from Republican businessman Keith Kern, who is now president of the Wisconsin Tavern League. And in that race, Milroy eked out a win by just 139 votes. You know, he joins seven other Democrats and 13 Republicans in the Wisconsin legislature that have already announced they won't seek re-election in the assembly. And that includes Bayfield Democrat Beth Myers. And also the Senate's top Democrat, Janet Buley of Mason, is one of six senators, three Democrats and three Republicans that have said they're not running again. Kelly Westland, who previously ran for Congress in northern Wisconsin against Sean Duffy, announced her candidacy for Buley's seat. And this is all coming at a time when Wisconsin has new legislative maps after redistricting. So it's a pretty tumultuous time for lawmakers right now and candidates throwing their hat in the ring.
All right. Well, Rick, on the Minnesota side, the 148th Air National Guard Wing is looking for new digs on the ground anyway.
Yes, a new hangar facility could spell a brighter outlook for the continued presence of the Minnesota Air National Guard's 148th Fighter Wing in Duluth. Bills have been introduced in the Minnesota House and Senate that would invest $25 million into such a facility. The unit's chief of public affairs, Audra Flanagan, said the current aircraft shelters were first built for the now-shuttered U.S. Air Force Base in Duluth. And after that facility was decommissioned, the structures were hauled to their present location at the Air National Guard Base in 1985. Duluth Chamber President Matt Baumgartner notes that the Air National Guard Base contributes an estimated $96 million per year to the local economy and employs more than 1,000 people. And that makes it the city's eighth largest employer. And while the 148th is currently equipped with F-16 Block 50 aircraft, Baumgartner explained that the hangar space the unit has at present is not appropriate for the next generation of fighter jets, likely the F-35.
All right. And with the continuing discussions about policing across the country, Duluth schools are considering changes with their school resource officer program.
Yes, they are. Leaders at Duluth Public Schools are set to weigh changes to their contract with the city's police department after reviewing data that indicates officers stationed in schools have cited non-white students at a disproportionately higher rate. A school board panel last week informally directed district administrators to review a contract with the city that puts one police officer apiece at Denfeld and East High Schools and Lincoln Park and Ordine East Middle Schools. But they have not yet decided whether they would reduce the number of officers or how they are deployed at those schools. According to the Duluth Police Department, Black students have received about 38% of the 96 citations issued by school resource officers between the beginning of the 2021-22 school year and March 15 of this year. But Black students only make up about 4% of the collective student body at the four schools, and this is according to the Minnesota Department of Education. There's a similar but less dramatic disparity for Native American students who received about 9% of citations but comprise only about 3% of the four schools' enrollment. And the opposite is true for white students who received about 30% of citations but make up nearly 79% of the student body.
All right. We've been speaking with Rick Lubbers, the executive editor of the Duluth News Tribune. Thank you, Rick.
Thanks, Robin.
And Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
And you can stay updated on these stories and all the regional news anytime at WPR.org and DuluthNewsTribune.com. And that's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. We leave you with more of the music of Molly and the Danger Band, who, as Molly said, are a danger only to themselves. Stay safe, everyone.